Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is Literary Viewpoints, and we have a really heart-wrenching book to speak about based on some real-life events. The book is One Man. The author that's here is New York Times author Andrew Gross, and the title of the book is One Man. Behind the barbed wires of Auschwitz, Professor Alfred Mendel was just another number whose knowledge was discarded as an old man's gibberish. But to the U.S. government, what Mendel knows could change the course of history. Andrew Gross is here, and he's going to tell us more. Good morning. How are you?
Hi, Fran. Nice to be with you. I'm good.
So what made you decide? I know you write thrillers because I've reviewed every single one of your books, in case you don't know.
Oh, no, didn't know, but it's great to hear.
Oh, I have. I just had to hook the right publicist, and I finally got the right one, and then I was lucky. What did you decide to change it from a thriller to write this type of a story about the concentration camps? Because this is an important topic, especially with what's going on in the news.
Right. Well, I guess the best way to say it without going on too long is that as someone who's written 10 what you would call suburban thrillers, meaning sort of upscale settings and, you know, yoga moms or hedge fund dads, or as someone said to me the other day, hedge fund moms and yoga dads. You know, I you know, putting the kids in peril, and, you know, maybe they have one foot in a legitimate family life and one foot into something murkier. I just felt that I was pushing a boulder uphill after 10 books, constantly trying to come up with the same entrapments and then extricate my characters out of it and find emotional solutions and denouements to the plot. And my whole career, I've wanted to write, you know, books of more heft with larger themes and more atmospheric settings. And, you know, publishers have a way of typecasting you in a certain niche, because when you start to try to brand an author, consistency is the most important attribute. So, you know, I went along willingly and certainly benefited from it, but had a bunch of New York Times bestsellers. But I wanted to do something else. And at some point, an idea presented me, my contract with HarperCollins came to an end. It was a long contract. And so I decided to let the boulder fall. And ultimately, I guess, to your question, my grandfather came here. Excuse me, my father-in-law came to this country in April of 1939, right before the war. And he never, ever, ever heard what fates befell anyone in his family. As it turned out, he was the only one in his family to survive the war. And He, like a lot of survivors, he never ever talked about his family at all and his upbringing in Poland or what life was like for him. Even my wife never knew the names of her paternal grandparents. He wouldn't even talk to me when I decided to write this book, but the memory was just too hard to bear. In 1941, when America entered the war, he joined up and enlisted, and because of his facility with languages, he was placed in the OSS, and he never spoke about his experience there as well. So he had all this sort of hidden life that he was a very sad guy. He always bore this sort of mantle of sadness, and I looked at him, and I think what I wanted to do is to write the story that he would have written, and so that's where the one man comes from.
I figured that was that he would have written it. This story, people, is so compelling. You've got to read it, but you've got to read it like a couple of chapters at a time, and then take it all in. You can't just read it. And I could read 400 pages in an hour, and this book took me 4 days because I wanted to make sure that I got it right and that I understood. Besides, there are so many heart-wrenching scenes and graphic scenes that it's hard to read all the way through. Which is exactly right. I mean, a lot of people came from Poland and Germany, and they don't want to talk about it. It's as if they just want to put it in the back of their minds like it never happened. So yeah. There were two.
Well, I didn't really set out to write a Holocaust novel. I set out to sort of delve into the sense of guilt or grief that my father-in-law felt. And that's what's at the heart of the book to me. And, you know, various other components, which, you know, I could talk about, you'll let me know if you want, you know, fell into place that sort of crafted the plot. But and then ultimately, I like books of pace, and I write thrillers. And, you know, I wanted a book that was a compulsively readable book, but at the same time, as you say, sort of has, I think, a bunch of memorable, you know, heart-wrenching or heartbreaking scenes to them. And I also sort of like to make people weep just a little, especially if it's in some way, you know, happy weeping in a way, you know. So.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm not going to talk about the ending of the book, but you got me on that one. I said, oh, my God. So there were two men that escaped. How did they escape? And tell us about them. And how did they find out about him?
The book actually begins, I guess, with a daughter who goes into her father's room in a VA hospital, and he's a person like I described with my father-in-law, who always carried this sort of mantle of sadness about his life and never conveyed what it was. And his daughter has found these three things. The man's wife has just died, and she's been cleaning out her mother's things, and she comes across in the attic this little tin, and in the tin are three things. One of them is a photograph of a sort of attractive woman rowing a boat who she doesn't recognize, a blonde, young, pretty woman. One of them is a white chess piece, a rook, and then the other is a medal, and not just any medal. It's the Distinguished Service Cross, which she says is only given for acts of extreme valor. How did you get this, Pop? Because he never spoke about it. And so to get to your question, he finally allows himself to speak about, you know, his own personal history, and he says it doesn't begin with any of these three things. It begins with two men who were running for their lives. And those two men were Rudolf Verba and Joseph Wetzler, two Czechs, actually, who were imprisoned at Auschwitz and worked in the administrative department and armed themselves with documentation just details about the atrocities that were taking place in Auschwitz, and were the only two people to have successfully escaped from Auschwitz. And they ended up making it to the Slovakian frontier, and within literally weeks, their accounts and their documentations appeared on the desk of FDR's war consul. And it was really the first time that people knew specifically what was taking place behind the barbed wires. Clearly, everyone knew something was going on. Entire villages were being transported, and no one was ever coming back, and no one was ever writing letters, and no one was ever heard from again. So there were enormous suspicions, but of course the German diplomatic corps was ramping that down and saying, you know, showing pictures that everybody had sort of a happy life. If you guys know the Theresienstadt is a camp that's outside Prague, and it was used as sort of a Red Cross showcase to show, you know, resettled Jews and whatever living a perfectly happy agrarian life, blah blah blah. And so no one really had a strong sense of the real atrocities that was taking place, and that was the benefit of these two men who escaped and set the plot of this book in motion.
That is the most powerful part, I know. And I know as I was reading this in other books, I know that at times that they were forced to write letters home from these places saying that they were okay or lying about how they felt.
Right. Everything
burned,
was censored,
executed,
right.
Yeah. That's
as a matter of fact, if you bring my attention to it at the end of our discussions, I'll tell you an interesting anecdote about something my wife found among my father-in-law's effects. It's a good closure more than now, but that had a lot that had the stamps of censorship on them. So remind me before we quit.
I did, because I said I sit and take notes while you're talking. I've got a pen in my hand, as a matter
okay.
of fact. I had a cast on my right hand, which I took off. I'm going to put back on later so that the doctor doesn't know I'm cheating, because I'm not supposed to type, but I don't care.
Don't set yourself back on my account, believe me.
No, it's
but
okay.
You know what happens with these two people is that it gets to FDR and Henry Stinson and Robert Morgenthau and Bill Donovan, who's head of the OSS, and then the question comes, what do we do about this? Now we know, what do we do about it? And FDR, who was certainly an embodiment of the human spirit, and his personal humanity was never in doubt, of course, I guess ultimately doesn't come across as much of a friend to the European Jews of this time, and for various reasons, they elect not to do anything. It's by the time this has come out, it's before D-Day, and Robert Morgenthau, who's a Jew, and in his war council is begging them, well, if we're not going to try to free these people or help these people, let's at least bomb the tracks leading into these camps and slow down the pace of the exterminations. And it's also argued against doing that. And I guess if any of your listeners have ever read Eric Larson's In the Garden of the Beast, which took place in Berlin in the 1930s, they know just how sort of, isolationist and I guess WASPy the State Department was, and they were always sort of downplaying what was happening to the Jews at that time, and there was a huge isolationist movement in this country, similar to the way it is now, with the Republicans sort of not wanting, one, to get involved in the war and not wanting to take in refugees, and early on, we were coming out of the Great Depression, and they didn't want to take in, refugees. But anyway, they decide not to go after the camps in this meeting, but they do agree to one mission. And that mission is basically to find one person who is an atomic scientist who has a particular expertise that they need on the Manhattan Project. And they, and that person, sadly, after they try to get him out of the country through various other, under the surface ways, it ends up in Auschwitz. And so now they have to convince someone to go on this suicide mission, someone who looks the part, a Jew, to go back to, in the case of my hero, where his parents were murdered by the Nazis, to go back there. And he has 72 hours to get himself inside the camp to find this guy, Alfred Mendel, and to smuggle him out. So that's basically what the book is about.
Well, I know. I sat and listened to Nathan Bloom. That's the character that goes back in. And I'm saying, why in his right mind would he do this? But he wanted to do something because his parents were murdered there. I remember reading that FDR just sort of discounted it, that a lot of them didn't want to believe it. And you get angry because 6 million, maybe even more, people died and for no reason, because Hitler hated Jews. And
right.
He
wouldn't have been able to save them all. As a matter of fact, I was just in New Orleans last week for a large mystery convention called BoucherCon, which people who listen may or may not know. But it's a big gathering of the industry, and I didn't realize it, but what they have in New Orleans is an absolutely first-class World War II museum that was basically the labor of love of Stephen Ambrose, the World War II historian. Anyway, one of the things they flash on the screen very quickly there are the casualties of World War II, and while they do list 6 million European Jews who are killed, what's also incredible is that 24 million Russians were died, and something I really didn't even know about, 20 million Chinese died in World War II. 20 million. So the numbers were staggering all over. But in any case, you know, getting back to the book, I think one of the moral tenets of this book is because there's, I actually got a letter from a rabbi who commended me for my use of rabbinical law in terms of sort of framing the moral and ethical issues that our character Nathan Bloom goes to decide whether he should go back or not. And one of them, of course, which comes out of the Mishnah, is it the same moral precedent to save one man as opposed to 6 million men? And that's what he tells himself, that by saving one man, he's essentially saving the world. And it comes out of the Sanhedrin, Mishnah Sanhedrin, it's Jewish teaching. I think Spielberg used it in Schindler's List, something similar. But this guy, for those of any of you guys out there who've been bar mitzvahed or go to temple, there's always the sense of that you give aliyahs, and aliyahs is basically a commitment that you'll go back to the Holy Land one day and honor it. And his aliyah is to go back to the land where his parents were murdered and do this deed in honor of his parents, and also in the shame and the guilt, which is what I'm really trying to get at. If you take it back to my father-in-law, let's say, of why he was able to escape and his parents left behind and his sister were murdered.
Well, I do understand. I know that Poland had an underground, and that's how my grandmother got here. Because my grandfather went back after being in Poland, and he went back and he went through the Polish underground to get her and her five sisters out.
Right.
They do know that there were some that never made it, that they never, ever, ever talked about, that nobody knows. I think she had two or three more sisters that we don't know about. We found out that my grandfather had family years later, that we had a whole family in England. So
yeah, it's extraordinary.
You just don't know.
No, you don't know, and every family has this torn history. And the book addresses that, and the book also actually weaves a little bit through the Polish underground in the book, because they are very involved in the plot to get these characters out of Auschwitz and to get them into Auschwitz as well. So
just reading what they had to do to escape and get out through the underground, I said, oh my God, she actually went through all that. That is scary. And you had to pray that the families that hid them didn't get caught. You can feel the hate, the disgust, the fear, and the indignities that so many endured. Your storyline, your dialogue, and your vivid scenes help readers get right into the story, and it's as if you're right there with them going through it. How did you make it so realistic that people would understand? Till this day, there are people that refuse to believe that the Holocaust happened, and that's really sad.
Right. Well, the truth is, I really didn't, like I said earlier, I really didn't set out to write the definitive Holocaust book or concentration camp book. What I wanted to do was write a book about heroism. And so to me, it was always a fine line that I tread between atrocity and heroism. I wanted to make things graphic enough that that it was clear that every day Bloom, every hour Bloom was in this place was a threat to his life. But at the same time, I wanted the book to sort of be an affirmative book and to be about his extraordinary sacrifice and heroism. But in terms of what you're saying, I'm a storyteller, and I think I've always sort of been able to write rich human characters in all the books I've written. And in this book, it was almost sort of easy to create that sense of humanity given what people had to go through. But you don't want to make people interesting through sympathy. You want to make them interesting through their own attributes. And certainly when we originally meet Alfred Mendel, scientist, he thinks he's actually going to be granted granted his passport papers to leave. In this case, France. He was being held in France in a detention camp, along with a lot of people who were given falsely Latin American passports, that they were all Latin American citizens. And this was a true thing. There were hundreds of Polish Jews who people at the Paraguayan embassy and the Costa Rican embassy tried to get out by claiming they were citizens of those countries. And the Germans, refused to let them move. The United States got involved. And in this case, the OSS, slips Mendel and his family these passports, or SATS passports, in order to get him out. And he comes within an eyelash of actually boarding a boat to get out. But at some point, they're discovered to be forgeries. And that's when, at the time that he thinks he's leaving, they're actually boarding a train to Auschwitz. So the rise and fall of this person's hopes, this family's hopes, is something that I think makes it so graphic, too, that they think this is the day that they've been waiting for a year, but what it is the day they're being shipped off to their deaths.
And yeah, he was the only one that didn't die, because they marched him right into the oven.
Yeah, and the only reason, I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but the only reason that Mendel, who's in his late 50s and not in the strongest condition either, is allowed to escape the left line of going straight to the gas, is that he's fluent in German, and that was handy in the camps, and so he's put on the other line, and the rest of his family isn't as lucky.
Yeah, every time I read about it, I get more angry, and I get more angry that no one actually did anything about it until it was too late for so many. So, the German expressions are not that different than some of the Jewish expressions and the Yiddish expressions that my grandfather taught me. So how did they came in the right place. We hear the soldiers screaming. We hear the prisoners, the horrific words. How did you decide on which specific German expressions to use?
Well, I don't know. I can't quite remember. It's just, you want to create authenticity as much as you can, and the rest of it is just a little bit of technique, and you don't want to show off. I mean, there's a fine line between showing off with information and boring your reader, or having your reader say, "You don't really need to know this. This is just like some cop talking about his gun. Like I've got a Glock 225, the front-loaded spring this and." Nobody cares, but in the case of this book, there's a lot of detail in this book. I've never written this kind of book before, because writing 6 books with Patterson and writing 9 books on my own, I was always sort of afraid that if I ever fell into the voice that I really wanted to write in, that my readers would just not read me, that they'd be bored. And I always sort of, when in doubt, I erred on the side of pace. And this book, I said, all right, look, I know I can keep a book moving, and as you know, Fran, that's not the problem in this book, but I want to layer in the kind of detail that will make this story more and more convincing. So there's detail in a lot of areas. There's detail in Jewish law. There's detail in physics. Everyone will get a little lesson in atomic physics. About how to separate, uranium isotope 235 from its more common cousin 238. But as you know, in that, it's sort of delivered in a really entertaining way as opposed to a boring way. And so I think it comes across as something, it's all about the detail. There's a lot of detail. I was really blessed that one of my neighbors where I live in Westchester mentioned to me parenthetically that she had these 2 memoirs from her, distant, elder, I don't know, grandmother, cousins, of their experience in the war. And it was a treasure trove for me, because not just I didn't really use their experiences in the war, but it just was a great lens into Jewish life in the late 1930s in Europe. So it's very rich in terms of what it was like to live as a Jew there, and then there's even a little chess thrown in. So there's all these themes, and there's a lot of detail and information, even as you say, the German that's used. So, you know, it's to me, the beauty of the book is in the richness of the details, you know, at least for me.
It was. I'll tell you, I had science teachers that could not teach science, and I learned more.
I'm losing you. I don't know if your listeners are, but I can't hear you.
No, I was on my. I have two phones, because just in case my cell phone, just my regular phone cuts out, I have it on my cell phone. I've got two phones that I'm on. This is better, right? Who is Leo? And he's very important. And
I like Leo.
He's so cool.
Yeah, everybody likes this character. And, you know, I got to be honest that one of the things I'm proudest of as a writer is sort of making secondary and tertiary characters as vibrant mm-hmm. as the lead characters. And I always sort of go back to, like, shows on TV like Frasier or Seinfeld. And it's not the lead character that's funny. It's the people he surrounds himself with that have smaller parts. And the real challenge to me is to make these sort of secondary characters richer, as rich as the lead. So, you know, Leo is someone who's in the camp, but he's a young, astonishingly gifted young 16-year-old who is the camp chess champion. And I don't want to give too much away, but Mendel, the scientist, and Leo form this alliance, and then Leo actually has some other relationships in the camp that prove to be critical when it comes to getting themselves out. And I guess, I'm sort of hesitant to sort of give some of the pleasures of the book away and why these characters exist, because, you know, it's not just that they run into characters, it's the role that some of these characters play that take the plot further.
Well, why did you decide, I mean, Auschwitz of all concentration camps, is that where your father-in-law was, in that particular one? That's
no,
probably
he wasn't
the worst
in a camp. My father-in-law was here before the war.
He was here. Yeah, we didn't talk about that, yeah.
Auschwitz was
one of the places my grandmother was in. I think Dachau was the other. And they did experiments on her.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, I'm certainly sad to hear that. I didn't want to get involved in that. And you know, there are many firsthand accounts of Auschwitz, and I certainly read many of them who will honor that internment more than I wanted to do in this book. As I said before, I really wanted to keep it about heroism, not atrocity. As a matter of fact, I insisted that Auschwitz not even appear on the flap of the book, because, you know, especially as a Jew myself, but I think people have said, I don't really want to read about Auschwitz. It's dark. I don't want to go back there. It'll be a bummer. You know, I've read the books. I've seen the movies. I've been to the museums, and it has this, you know, terrible, dark connotation to it. And I think you'll agree that it's not a dark book.
No.
And it has more affirmation than cruelty in it, I think. So I just sort of don't really, you know, I struggled whether I should even set it there. The reason I did ultimately is that the Jews that were held at Bittel, who were under these Paraguayan passports, some 260 of them, where Alfred Mendel is at the beginning of the book, all these Jews were shipped to Auschwitz, and I thought just to honor the history, I would set it there, but I had a struggle whether I should just set it at some obscure nameless camp, and, you know, Auschwitz, like I said, comes with its own message that that I just didn't want the book to represent exactly.
Well, I read a lot about it. I did some more research on it. I even saw some pictures of it. And I think what made it so poignant and what made the book so more realistic is because you set it in a place that really did exist.
Mm-hmm.
At least to me, because a fictitious place is just a fictitious place. And if I'm looking at
right.
an advanced reader's copy, people. So I don't know if this is the same cover with the snow and one man standing.
Yeah, that's
in
the same
snow.
Cover, but I'm not sure all the marketing, you know, stuff is the same. So
I don't know. All I know is that you see a lone person and you can't see his face or anything.
Yeah,
so you begin to
cover.
Wonder where
yeah.
he's. Yeah, it is. It's the cover says it all, actually. So who is Martin Frank? And when we hear his voice, he treats people as if they are lottery numbers. How come? And if he doesn't get the amount of numbers that he wants there, he goes off. How come? Is that how
well,
they treat these
I don't know. We may be talking about two different characters. You know, Martin Frank, who's a major in the German intelligence division, is kind of the Inspector Javert, you know, from Les Miserables, of this book. He's a person who was serving the Reich in Portugal and suffered a setback, and his goal now is to restore his rank and his name, and he's been given this sort of petty job of tracking down Jews who might be in the Aryan sector in Warsaw, and through his own brains and a good sniffing nose himself, begins to have a sense that someone might have landed near Auschwitz on some kind of mission of rescue. And certainly, you know, he's single-minded in trying to get the German authorities convinced of this and track this person down.
Mm.
The camp commander, whose name is Ackermann.
Yeah, that's.
He's not a bean counter because he's not a. People were not human to him. They were just numbers. And his quotas, his daily quotas. He's actually the assistant commandant, and while the commandant, whose name was Huss, is in Berlin, he's there trying to show that he can keep the business of the camp, which is the death toll, right up at his quota. And so all he cares about is meeting his numbers to advance his career. And he has a wife named Marta, who plays a role in the book. She's maybe a little more disaffected than he is. And all he is now is someone that wants to advance, and the only way he can advance is to just dispose of as many people as quickly as they can.
Yeah, it's like it's she had a little bit more heart, and she befriended somebody else, but we won't say who. But you began to understand her, and she began to sort of understand what was really going on. After a while.
Yeah, I think some of the feedback I've had is that I haven't treated Germans as stick figures in this. And, you know, there were some that sort of towed the party line. There are others that are maybe open to bribery or open to some interaction with the inmates. Mm-hmm. And then there's Marta, the wife of the commandant, who engages a character like I said, you know, finds a way to play a role, a larger role in the book, and I think shows a lot of humanity and a lot of, I think who she is comes across before she's a Nazi, you know, certainly, you know.
Yeah. The sad part is, I wonder, I mean, Hitler brainwashed so many people. So many young people, so many other people just to go along with him, and yet no one dared to go up against him. I wonder what would have happened if somebody finally turned around and said, let's get him.
Let's get whom exactly?
Hitler.
I'm sorry.
In other words, they were also afraid of Hitler and what he might do if he went against them.
Well, people did try to go against him.
They didn't want to kill all these people.
Yeah, I mean, people did try to go against him. Maybe too late, and it just didn't go well. But there's also, you know, I think I DVR'd it, but I haven't seen it yet. But Tuesday night, there was a documentary on PBS called Those Who Defied the Nazis. And it's a story of people who hid Jews, people who stood up against Hitler, people who smuggled people out. So I think there were more people who did do that than are regularly, you know, brought out. But yeah, I mean, you know, for most people, they believe that their fates lied with what their leader was espousing, or they just turned a blind eye to it, you know. So, but you know, like I said, I want to just draw a little bit of a distinction between the Holocaust in general and that which the narrow part of it that I've used to build this story off of.
Well, this story, I mean, if people don't believe that it really happened, then they've got a problem. And it's sad because as you listen to the news and all the murders and the rioting in some of the states in North Carolina and what happened in New Jersey, what happened in the city, I mean, there were 800 packages reported to the police department today that were suspicious, and thank God they were nothing. It's scary. It's scary.
Of course. Yeah,
and no matter
where
you are, you're not immune to when they want to get you, they get you. That's what's really bad. And the fact that the FBI knew that this guy for 2 years was on their watch list and didn't think that he was anybody is even scarier. And they don't even know if he's going to make it to question him. So,
yeah, I don't even think he was on their watch list, actually. You know, I think they knew of him, but he wasn't on them. So, yeah.
His father even said that he told the police, FBI 2 years ago, that they should do, you know, look at his son. It's too bad, you know, they didn't find anything. It's scary. Well, they know how to hide themselves anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But they still don't know if he's by himself or he did it with somebody else. It just sounds that I can't believe that he was just alone. So when you created fear and hope and the horrors on one hand and the kindness and love of Alfred and Leo on the other, to counterbalance the SS officers, they showed no mercy. Were there any SS officers that even remotely, everyone was the same? They were all out to kill and torture. And yet, Alfred and Leo, how did they manage to survive?
Well, they probably wouldn't have survived for too much longer. You know, I think the people, the SS, did their jobs, and as cruel and inhuman as it was, and I think that you know, that within the camp there was a whole sort of second row of existence other than just survival. Survival might have been 80% of it, but there was still, you know, sort of a commerce in the camp. There was guards who were open to bribery. There were ways to get food, or, as I showed in the camp, ways to get into the women's camp if you had a wife or a girlfriend there. You know, there was this, I don't want to say thriving, that wouldn't be accurate, but there was this underbelly of activity that allowed stuff to go on in the camp. You know, one of the themes in the book is chess. Leo is the camp chess champion, and when Alfred first comes upon him, he's winning that title, and you know, so you could play chess even though it was played with manufactured sort of pieces. You know, there was life there as well. So what I wanted to show a little bit was, you know, part of that life where prisoners can have their own sort of sardonic humor about survival. You know, that it wasn't all this sort of ghoulish hell that, Bosch would have painted. You know, you know, survival was difficult. And frankly, we're not, you know, even in my story, you can see how close some of the characters came to not surviving. I mean, you know, there's, you know, in one case, you know, Bloom is faced imminently with not surviving. So, you know, it was a daily challenge, but still there were other aspects of life there that showed the humanity of the inmates.
They had each other, and they had nothing more than that. And each time I read about Nathan Bloom, I said, like, oh, my God, I can't believe you're doing this. And as Alfred Mendel related the things about atomic science, the fact that a Leo was able to transcribe it, yet he said he didn't understand it, but he was able to remember it. And that was totally amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So, before I forget, and I don't want to forget, I don't forget anything they tell me, next Tuesday, and I'm going to hopefully do another one in December, if you can do one, we're doing a panel show. And we're doing a panel show with some people that I think you know, John Land, Alan Topol, Alan Jacobson, and Simon Gervais. We're talking on Tuesday at special time, because everybody lives all over the planet at 3 o'clock, and I never do shows at 3 o'clock, but they asked me for a favor. Multiple plot Tuesday. How do you write multiple plots in your novels and keep the readers from not using my, as an educator, graphic organizer to organize the different parts of it? And these four, right, they're fantastic. And John always says you get more out of my books than I do when I tell you. And October 6th, Paranormal Wednesday with Brian Moreland, Mel Corcoran, and Lisa Unger. And I received an email yesterday, and I was, like, so excited. On October 18th, Tess Gerritsen is going to talk about her book, Playing with Fire, the Incandescent Incendio, the music that she created for the book to go with it. And we're going to talk about partial complex tremors and epilepsy related to the book.
Sounds good.
It's like mind-boggling. I do research every time I have to do something like this. On the 20th, I've got Bill Larkin, and on the 25th, I have Andrea Crane, My Heart's Desire, the 25th anniversary. Bill Larkin's book is A Bullet Under the Blue Sky. And finally, on Halloween, the book totally fits, Bruce Coffin, Among the Shadows. And that's just October. November, you won't believe what's going to happen. So I can't believe sometimes that all these people, this is fantastic, and I get to read the best books of all. So what made you decide to write this, and you think your audience will get the message? I mean, there are some, like you said, that won't get the message, but do you think people are really aware at this point that this really happened? And that there's a message of, I guess it's the guilt that you feel that your father-in-law felt because he survived?
I wasn't trying to sort of shout out that the Holocaust existed. I mean, I think everyone, you know, is well-versed in that. If there are some that don't, it's not my role to try to convince them, and this book isn't that. But like I said, what I wanted to do was tap into the guilt, the survivor guilt, the sense of shame, the sense of grief that I always felt that my father-in-law felt having survived this and his family didn't. So I said I would sort of, near the end, tell you a little anecdote. After he died this year, he was 96, and after he passed away in February, my wife was going through his belongings and came across something astonishing. And what it was this trove of letters that were written to him by his mother in the first year or two that he was in this country, which he had never shared before to anyone. And for my wife and her brother, this was an extraordinary discovery. So they were in Polish, of course. We had someone literally translate them within 24 to 48 hours because we used it in a memorial service we had for him in Florida. And when they came back, they showed this modern, heartfelt, humorous woman who was named Regina, who was their grandmother, who they had never met before, who they never knew anything about. And The letters were interesting for a couple of reasons. One, like the first couple were from their regular address, and then they moved. And when they moved, the letters were suddenly signed Warsaw, Deutschland, which we thought was interesting. And they began to be stamped with a swastika. And we assume that that was a censor who the letters were passing to, you know, having to pass through to be sent. And the one thing that she, his mother, kept on saying to my father-in-law, all of 17 or 18, why have you not written us back? How are you, Nathan? Because his name was Nathan, too. Is everything all right there? Are you receiving my letters? Please write us back. And it's likely that whatever he wrote back was not being delivered. And ultimately, when the war was over and they died and he didn't know anything about their fates, what he did feel, I think, if I could read his guilt, and it's very compelling to me, is that his parents died never knowing if he loved them, if he wrote them back, if he thought of them, you know, and that's so sad.
Yeah.
And to me, that's what he carried with him all those years. That was the guilt and the, you know, the feeling of grief that he took so much on his own shoulders that, yes, it's one thing to lose a parent, but thinking of them going off to their fates, never even knowing if their son cared for them or was receiving their letters or ever wrote them back, that's a lot to bear. So I'm happy if my book played some part in that resolution coming out.
That's sad that he had that he didn't believe that his parents in his own head would realize that he cared about him them. But I imagine since she's your wife's father, right? That how did he interact with her? He was not the same, was he? Did he showed his that he cared about his children?
Or
did he have
a
problem
doing
that?
I mean, I think his parents totally cared about him. I mean, these letters were reaching out to him, but who knows the fates of the letters? I assume he wrote back, but who knew the fates of the letters he wrote back? Clearly they
probably
were never delivered.
Probably never got there, yeah.
Well,
it's so sad, and you think you get mail, and you don't get mail, and oh, gosh. So one last question before we ask what's next and how everybody can find out about you. And I realize that you're the Andrew Gross that wrote with James Patterson, and, of course, I read James Patterson. It's just he keeps changing publicists. So every time I send for his books, for some reason, it's a different person. And I don't know who the new person is, and I really want to get his new one. Peter Straus, Alfred Mendel, and Nathan Blum and Leo, if they could speak to us right now, what would they say that happened to them? What message would they get? Would they want to give to anyone that's reading this powerful book?
Well, I think it would be a message that humanity wins in the end, that in spite of evil, you know, we all, and, you know, I think this is a modern message too, have to take steps to combat it in our own way. And each of these characters did something different. You know, Alfred Mendel knew that he knew something that was proprietary, that needed to survive at all costs. Peter Straus, who we haven't mentioned, was the OSS captain that organized the raid and that sent Blum off on this suicide mission. You know, Blum is someone who, to honor his parents, was willing to, the legacy of his parents, was willing to take on, you know, this dangerous mission. You know, they're all people who stood up in the face of evil, I guess, or of overwhelming odds. And so, to me, that's sort of the richness of humanity that makes not only the book, but gives the human race hope. And I think that's one thing that this book does. It ends on a strong message of affirmation of character and humanity and hope. It's not bleak. It's warm-hearted, you know. And so I think that's what they would all say.
That is true. And I just wonder if what we could do today to stop what's happening in the world, because the same thing is going to happen. That's the scary part, is that the more you hear about these ISIS and Al-Qaeda and all of them and what's happening in New York and everywhere else, you begin to wonder, just they're even more deadly than anybody
well,
else.
Well,
my own view
is that this isn't organized. This latest person was another sort of misfit who gets under the spell of a charismatic, you know, a leader, and I don't think ISIS organized this. I don't think ISIS knew about him.
Either.
I don't think he was in touch with ISIS. And my own view is that I don't want to get political, but I think these things are milked in a way in times of elections because. You know, because people's fears have a way of coming out. The truth is, I think we've had very few terrorist actions, very few in the size of our country. You look what's happening in Europe, where it's running around zero, and this is a daily constant fear. In the United States, there really hasn't been any organized, you know, sort of thing. Everybody's been a lone wolf. You know what? You can't really stop that any more than you can stop mass murders in movie theaters. I think it's disingenuous of Trump to suggest you can do it. And I just think this is a fact of life that we're all going to deal with in our times. There's going to be a premium for death by terrorism, the same way that there's death by airline, you know, crashes. And if it was the kind of thing where there were groups of people who were operating here, like on 9/11, that's a whole different ticket to me than these sort of misfits and basically criminals who get under the sway of someone on the internet and decide they're going to act it out. You know, so heartfelt condolences to the people who were affected by this. It's horrible, but. I think to sort of make it seem like, you know, this is the equivalent of Nazi Germany. Maybe ISIS is the equivalent of the Nazis. I have no, yes, ma'am. But I just don't see this as some sort of wave that's infiltrating our country. So anyway.
I hope not. I hope not. It's scary. So I just read a book that everyone should read. It's called You Will Not Have My Hate, about a man that lost his wife in the first attacks in France, and he wrote an open letter to Facebook to them, and it's the most beautiful letter, letting them know that he's not going to give up on his life, and he's not going to hate them, and he's not going to allow them to take away his hate. Given his hate, he's going to move on with his life, and he and his son are going to make it. It was a 100-page book, and I read it in like a half an hour. It was absolutely heartbreaking, but really good. So, what's next for you? What am I getting next to read?
What's next for me is already, I turned it in yesterday, as a matter of fact. I was going to post it on Facebook. It's another World War II book. It could be called The One Man Two because it's the story called The Saboteur, and it's no Jews in this one, but it's the story of a combined British and Norwegian raid that ended the Nazis' attempts to create an atomic bomb, and it's a raid on the German heavy water facility in Vemork, Norway, and it was a raid where one person basically changed the course of the war through this extraordinary act of singular heroism. And this book is a bit like an Alistair MacLean book of like Where Eagles Dare or The Guns of Navarone. It's sort of a suspense, a more straightforward suspense adventure, and it's a very stirring story as well. So another World War II book, and then we shall see.
When is this coming out?
Not sure. Probably next August, I would guess, but not exactly sure. So.
Well, I need to get
one of the things
reader's
of having.
Copy.
Sorry.
I want an advanced reader's copy.
Well, I mean, I just turned it in. It's going to be 7 months before.
Edited. I know. It takes forever. And
so
where can everybody find out more about you and your work? So that I'm going to put out a link again. I'm going to post the review. And I belong to at least 50 sites, maybe more. But my site on WordPress is Just Reviews. That's where everybody finds me. And MJ Magazine is my online magazine. And I'm going to put the review in there to feature it as a start.
That's super.
Review.
Thank you, Fran.
MJ9 is... if you want to write an article about World War II, about why you wrote the book, I would love it. I'm putting it together. It's not going to come out till next month, until I get all the pieces that I want. It's an online magazine, and since it's mine, I can put in whatever I want.
Mm-hmm.
And,
good. Well, anybody can find me at andrewgrossbooks.com or write me at andrew@andrewgrossbooks.com or find me on Facebook. I'm easy to find. I've got a couple of pages, my fan page, my personal page. Even Twitter, although I'm not on there much. But so, you know, like any writer, I'm pretty available, easy to find me. And if any of your listeners go out and buy the book, which I hope you will, because I think you'll be thankful you did.
Mm-hmm.
It's, by all means, get in touch with me and share your thoughts on it.
Well, I can tell you now that I got a text the other day from my brother-in-law that does read you, and he's in Florida, and he wants me to mail him the book. So it's in my hand, and he's lucky to get
it. Well, tell him to buy it.
That's exactly what I've been telling everybody.
Don't tell an author that you're going to mail him the book. An author that you convinced
him
to buy the book, even if you didn't.
I said you no, I can't, because you know why? Because it costs more to send it by FedEx to Florida than it would for him to just go online
right.
and buy it and get
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, you're supporting authors, and the only way you can,
right.
you know, I mean, we don't live for free any more than anybody does. So you know, it's sort of the same thing when you go to a book event. You know, it's always nice to buy a book, even if you buy a paperback book. It just shows support for why someone came to talk to you. So the same thing. When your brother-in-law says, send me the book, say, I want this copy. You buy it.
Tell him maybe,
I'm
you know, when your birthday's in December, if you're lucky, I'll send it to you for a present. But you're not getting mine. And I write in the books, and I, you know, literally write in them, take notes and destroy them so he wouldn't be able to read it anyway. That's
okay.
How
I was sort of teasing in this whole thing. But
that's okay. I stopped doing that along. As a matter of fact, I sent him like 20 books, and I said, like, this is like $100 just to mail him books? Go get it yourself.
I hear you.
Seriously speaking. But we seem to be in the same vicinity. I'm in Upper Westchester, too.
Cool. I'm in Lower Westchester.
Yeah.
So, great.
I'm in East Westchester. I used to be in the Bronx. That's what made me so tough, my mother said. And the reason why I read is because she made me read 10 books a week besides taking Hebrew lessons, piano lessons, and every other lesson that she could possibly come up with, and 36 years of teaching in an elementary school in the Bronx that I loved every minute of as a reading specialist. So she taught me at an early age of 3, you're reading, start reading chapter books, and I guess I've always been doing it ever since. So I wanted to thank you so much, and would you consider doing a panel show on writing in different time periods?
You could, let me know, and, it's easy to click in, even we spend our winters in Florida, but if, easy to get in anywhere, you can certainly let me know when you're going to do that, and it's been a fun hour, and glad to be with you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Glad
I really
appreciate
it. Thank
you so much. Thanks. You're welcome.
I loved it. And anybody that needs a present, because Christmas and Hanukkah are coming, why don't you get a couple of dozen copies of One Man by Andrew Gross while you're at it?
Thanks, Fran.
You won't be sorry. Well, what I do in December, seriously, is I do the panel show, and then we do the authors can promote their books. So it's a twofold thing. It's a panel on a topic, and then it's promote your books. And I hope I get to see
Alrighty.
You at the Thriller Fest next year.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You too. Bye. Everybody,
Bye.
Have a nice day. The sun's shining, and if you have nothing better to do, read a book.